Welcome, everybody, to the summer season of Writers at Warwick. I never begin chairing any of these readings by advertising, but tonight is different. You must buy real. It is amazing. It's amazing not only for the individual poems that are in it, but for the whole trajectory of the book, the whole architecture of the book, which I'll be asking George about after the reading. And when you get home, I don't want you to read it silently to yourself over a glass of red wine, like poetry lovers do. I want you to do what I did yesterday, which is to read it aloud. I want you to read it aloud to your best friends, your family, and your lover, or your lovers, in which case, multiple copies.
Argument for polygamy, I think.
And to your dog. I'm very pleased to welcome the author of Real, George Surtees. George was born in Budapest in 1948. He arrived in England as a refugee in 1956, which is about all he has in common with Michael Howard.
Glasses.
And he was brought up in London. He was trained as a painter. For some years, he exhibited and ran a small etching and poetry press, which I think is called Starwheel Press, was it?
Yep.
With his wife, the artist Clarissa Upchurch, who's here today and whose paintings are behind us. His poems began to appear in the mid-1970s and won many distinguished prizes. He published variously with Secco and Warburg until they went west with poetry, and then with Oxford University Press until they went east with poetry, and then with the stalwarts, or one of the great stalwarts, Blood Axe Books. He was elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 1982. After his return to Hungary in 1984, he translated poetry, fiction, and plays from the Hungarian, and for this work he has received the European Poetry Translation Prize, the Derry Prize, and the Golden Star Medal of the Hungarian Republic.
Now, which I'm not wearing at the moment. As
Now, I remember about 15 years ago when I was a young tyke of a poet, I used to throw myself at the feet of older poets as a kind of act of apprenticeship. I used to turn up at their houses, knock on their doors with a copy of their book, and just say, "Bow wow, will you please teach me about how to write poetry?" And one of the people I turned up at was a man, the late, great William Scammell. And William Scammell knew of George. In fact, he knew George, which I found terrifically impressive at the time. And William and I used to sit smoking and drinking whiskey. I in total silence, usually caused by awe and alcohol. And he used to artfully talk about the angels of poetry. He used to talk about the kind of the fledged angels of poetry and separate them from the clipped angels of poetry. And the clipped angels of poetry from those who were simply egg-bound. Now, George, his name, was always among the very fledged and super-soaring super-angels of poetry. And his reputation among poets has always been of the highest. And that's not only because of his poetry, it's because of his generosity, it's because of his advocacy, particularly through translation, and also the amazing éclat he has as a jazz pianist. Now, that reputation has been very high since he began to publish. And this year, George received the T.S. Eliot Prize for his new collection, Real, which you are going to buy. Anyway, I'm delighted to have him here. Please give him a Warwick welcome.
Thank you. In Wyndham, the station master of Wyndham Railway Station, which is an independently owned railway station, he's a very, very nice man. He's not only a station master, he sells pianos, he tunes pianos. He runs a restaurant called The Brief Encounter. And he wrote me a lovely little letter recently. And apropos of a poem I read on television about... It's a Holocaust Day poem. And in this little card, he said, well, many congratulations, etc., etc. So I went to see him, in fact, only yesterday. And he said, George, he said, I didn't know you were Polish. And I said, well, I'm Hungarian, but it's much the same. and he said, I didn't know you'd lost all your family in the war. And I said, well, not all of them. most of them, but not all of them. And then he said, you're such an excellent pianist. And this is not true. I'm a very, very mediocre pianist, but I do have a great deal of fun playing. What I'm doing, I read about 20 minutes to half an hour, and I say little things in between poems. I won't say a vast amount, only as much as I think may be useful to sort of take breaks between the poems. And I will read chiefly from Ariel, but I will begin with one poem, which is from a Budapest file, which was originally written in 1985, 86, I think. It appeared in A Photographer in Winter. And this is the poem called A Photographer in Winter, or at least one section of it. The photographer in winter was, in fact, my mother, who was a photographer. And we left the country in winter. And at that stage, whenever I thought of Hungary, where I was born, I kind of thought of winter. So in a way, it's a personal poem. But in another way, it's a poem about hand colouring. My mother was a photographer. And one of the things she did, because she was ill, is that she did an awful lot later when she could no longer be a photographer. She was a retoucher and a hand colourist. And this poem is about hand colouring and about its truth to life. And because it's about its truth to life, I kind of think of it as a kind of notion of, if like, what literature or poetry, what relationship it stands to vis-a-vis life, and how much of it is hand colouring, how much of memory is hand colouring. Hand colouring, it was a form of art. And when you bent over your work, I saw how art could not obey a natural law, that faces flowered and that teeth shone pale as distant neon. Memory would fail to keep the living and the dead apart. To be quite honest, it was creepy watching this process of embalmment, as it seemed, to see the smoothed-out features, the redeemed perfection of the unbelievable, showing no signs of ever having lived, but glowing pink and white. I find it strangely touching. And that was art, you said, the difficult. But you were lying, or just didn't know. And even then, so many years ago, the images had started to assume the frozen aspect of an empty room, imperfect, white, and granular as salt. And now it's winter, and this dreadful weather is always at the very edge of spring, but cannot make or fake it. I can't bring another year to light. You sit alone with all the pictures that the wind has blown away, and art must somehow fit together. So the argument is, I guess, about what art does and how art sort of fits things together, how it colours things, and what we feel about that colouring. I want to read just another part of a poem. This is from Riel. It's called Meeting Austerlitz. It's in memoriam of W.G. Sebald, who I think was a wonderful writer. I knew personally, not terribly well, but he died just a few miles away from us. And his death was very, very moving. And this poem is a ghost story, in a way. It begins with a meeting with Sebald's ghost. Sebald is almost kind of interchangeable with the figure of Austerlitz, Jacques Austerlitz, who is one of the characters in the last major novel he published in English translation. And again, it's to do with what is trustworthy, what you think of as truth, what you hope for, what you hope may be truth. And it begins in winter, about the time that he died. The cold sat down with frozen fingers. Cars were iced up. The pavements were treacherous. Boys in T-shirts drifted to doors of bars in quiet market towns. The shops were a chorus of seasonal favorites, everyone the same. We were jollying ourselves up for Christmas without much money and no sense of shame, because this was a time for giving and for joy. We were all good intentions. So the postman came and went. Lorries delivered supplies. The boy with the papers zipped about on his bike. Parents were packing the latest must-have toy, each one expensive, everyone alike. The butcher's whole family were busy serving, and no one had fallen ill or gone on strike. On ungritted roads, motorists were swerving to avoid each other. Nothing had come to bits in the houses of the whole and the wholly deserving. Nothing was incomprehensible or beyond our wits. And I myself was taking a quiet stroll in the nearby fields when I met Austerlitz. It was some way off the road, and he was the sole patch of dark in the bright mid-afternoon. "Hello, Max," I said. And he looked up with that droll, melancholy expression. There was the faintest moon visible in the sky. "Both day and night," he grinned. "It'll be dusk pretty soon. In Lalla Rookh, if I remember right, I've not read Thomas More for several years. There's a veiled prophet, Hakim, who radiates light and draws the moon from a well. When it appears, it eclipses the real moon. Perhaps we have invented the sad pale thing there with its terrible shears." The air was frosty, oddly tobacco-scented. Thick grey clouds rose from his mouth as he spoke. I could not be certain whether the wisps that entered my mouth were frozen breath or cigarette smoke. Everything had a double, or existed in some version of itself, wrapped in a winter cloak. It was as if an enormous window had misted. Austerlitz was looking across the field. Beyond the window there were buildings twisted into macabre shapes. Some creature squealed in the distance. A car growled briefly past, then silence, complete and vacuum sealed. The poem basically goes on with a series of conversations with this ghost, the ghost of Sebald, who I think hit something in those books of his which seems so absolutely true and resonant to me that, and not only to me, of course, but to many, many people, that it strikes one with the force of truth, if you like, even though in the sort of Sebald books there are misplacements, there are things which appear like memory. There are sort of parts where somebody says that somebody once said, somebody once told him, and so on. I want to read now from a section of Riehl, which is called Flesh. Flesh. My Hungarian is still a little awkward. Flash, flesh. An early family history. And again, this is to do with, I suppose, the relationship between what you make up and what you believe or what you think you remember. It's an attempt. I'd written over the last 20 years or so quite a lot about stuff which appears to be memory, although I have never completely trusted this memory, even in myself, so that there's this kind of hedging about with memory. Flesh, Early Family History, begins with a set of poems, a section called Forgetting. And all the first five poems are about forgetting. And they try to remember scenes that nobody can remember. You're a baby. Your mother leans over your cot. She puts her hands out and she picks you up. Well, maybe you can remember it. I can't remember it. It begins from there. And there are five poems on the notion of forgetting before we get to the subject of memory. So this is the very first one. Naturally enough, it's called Mother. The first hand coming down from heaven, her hand. She hovers above you. It is a premonition of life to come, a bird preparing to land. Your mother's warmth, her breasts, an impression of intensity as softness, and then the bones of her knuckles, cheeks, neck, the motion of her head, swing of her hips, the delicate cones of her nipples, the mystery of the navel, heat, cold, wet, dry, milky smells and pheromones. Where do you begin? With fingers tickling feet or lips against skin? Being lifted high, then swung to safety? The noises of the street, your minor disasters, hearing your own cry echo in your head. There's something lost, something buried deep under the eye you try to see with, something faint as dust settled inside your lungs, a history tucked in the folds of your body like a cast. The radio mumbles, a bell rings suddenly, light moving across the floor, over the ceiling. The bird rustles her hair. The branches of a tree against the window, knocking and squealing. Of course, it's made up. You cannot know these things exactly, but you think you know them. You think you recognize them. So I think it's a recognition. I'm not sure it's a recognition of what, but a recognition of something. The second section is called First Things First. I'm going to read three poems from three of the sections. And this is about the first things that you come into contact with. And they all stand for slightly different things. There's a piano, which we definitely did have a piano in a flat in Budapest. There's a stove, one of these big ceramic affairs that you still find in sort of Eastern Europe, which you just keep feeding all through winter. There's a swing, which is set up between two doors. It's set up in a doorway between two rooms in a flat. There's a possession of a lead soldier, and there's a book. All these things stand for slightly different kind of experiences, but I kind of remember them all. But again, treat this memory as though it were imagination. This is stove. The incinerated history of the block is trapped within these terracotta stoves, grumbling and wheezing like a carriage clock, or faintly glowing like upended loaves. In winter, our great aunts, the elderly, huddle beside them in fingerless gloves, grow older, more transparent, tenderly beckoning us to join them. The stove sweats and sighs with the wind in the frozen northerly forests we read about, where dogs and cats are children in disguise. Life goes up in flames. The familiar is swept under magic carpets. Their gingerbread brown is focus for our games. We creep up on each other. We touch the tiles with drops of water that glitter like tiny gems sizzling into silence. The stove's mouth smiles through its black grill. It could possibly teach us something, but what? Downstairs, the piles of logs, coal heaps, old jam jars, the dark niche of the cellar with its guttered candles. We learn its sunken topography, its slow, muttering speech, and bring our rusty buckets with stuff to burn. And the third section of this is to do with secret languages, the way you first get to know language. You hear the radio next door, a bit of music fairly early on. You learn swearing from the daily who comes in. I mean, we were brought up in a kind of in a communist society. Both my parents went out to work, and the only way the children could be looked after is you got some sort of local woman who came in and cleaned and did a bit of cooking and so forth. And we certainly learned swearing from her. Newspaper, which used to be lining the drawers. And lastly, the pipes. I'll read you the pipes. There's an image in there which I think sometimes maybe this still needs a little bit of. The curious furry hat of adulthood. What it is that people are smoking pipes. You see them as children smoking pipes, and a pipe and the smoke rises above them like some kind of Russian hat, you know. And this is all these things are about how you are kind of initiated into adult experience. Having been born into an age of pipes, we knew integrity by its sour smell. Our parents' friends were intellectual types who drew and sucked like imperturbable monoliths in their dashes by the lake and tapped their sepia fingers on the table, occasionally producing a dark flake of tobacco from their spittled lips. They rocked in cane chairs set on porches, half awake, while in the darkness the clock ticked and tocked and water gently slopped among the reeds. Their silences were too grave to be shocked by wars or arguments or infantile misdeeds. The village dogs slunk by. They puffed and spat like monuments with barely human needs. Tall wreaths of smoke. The curious furry hat of adulthood. Contentment. Stillness. We respected their silence. Their empty, flat voices. Their deaths would be ours eventually. We would light their pipes, enter their myths. When the clock stopped ticking, we too would be free to turn ourselves into such monoliths. I read perhaps one poem. I've read about four more poems here. This is not from real. It's going back. I mean, as David said, I've kind of been through a few publishers. And I've had this remarkable kind of luck of falling upstairs, which doesn't often sort of happen. I always thought I was falling downstairs, and then something always sort of rather nice happened. When I went to Bloodaxe, they decided, because they wanted to kind of republish all the things I'd done, to divide me into two, a Hungarian me and an English me, which I sort of agreed to. And I always wondered afterwards whether this is a wise thing, but it's happened. And an English apocalypse is like me writing about England and trying to, and it's a whole book. So I just read you one poem, which is in fact a slightly more oblique one. It's called Keithley, which is Yorkshire. And it's a memory of our own car, my own car, this Morris Minor, which you see about halfway through the poem, which has been abandoned because its big end went and it was completely vandalized by the time we returned. It's Yorkshire where I did my art training in Leeds. At night you can see the north wind as you lie sleepless because the net curtains bulge with it and the whole room seems to sigh and billow as if the moors were about to divulge a dreadful secret. Black earth, scrub, thin grass. The weather here is willing to indulge its resident Heathcliffs from the deep base of fogged valleys or screaming tips of rock. On a bend down Keithley Way, you might pass a cannibalized Morris Minor in a state of shock, its big end gone, its eye sockets picked bare by scavengers, dewdrops dangling from the lock of its open door. There is something in the air stripping the paint away. Nature, perhaps, nothing more. The power concentrated there, escaping through the bleak beauty that claps its arms around things, around trees and cars and old men dropping ash in their own laps in front of the TV and the latest soap stars, with a dog by the door wanting to go out into the wind across the becks and scars. I very much loved Yorkshire and always wanted to go back to it. I already finished with three poems. At the end of Reel, and I've always tried to sort of structure books. I've always felt that reading a poetry book, I know one actually sort of picks them up and kind of read a bit there, read a bit there. But it's given me a kind of sense that I'm doing something which has a kind of narrative, if you like, or a sort of shape. If I imagine the book being read from the front, so you kind of come to bits and pieces as you go. Towards the end of this book, there's a series of poems which have an interesting kind of literary existence. The series is called Morpheus, the Morpheus Annotations. Morpheus is a book of short stories by Catherine Hacker, who's a German novelist and short story writer. I read her book, met her, and I loved these short stories, which are basically taking classical myths and relocating them, which is an old game. There's nothing particularly new about that. But I just thought she did something so fascinating with it. And what I wanted to write was poems that lived in the crevices of those texts. So I'll read you two of these. Elpenor, who's a very minor Greek character, is one of Odysseus's comrades, who was, in fact, quite young. And when Odysseus and his companions were escaping from Circe's isle, he got left behind because he was drunk, and he had to leap across a gap, and because he was drunk, he didn't make it, and he fell to his death at the bottom. So he's a kind of lost character. Elpenor is really about drunkenness, I think. And it's a kind of tender poem about drunkenness. Elpenor. We were fond of Elpenor. Generous, kind, intelligent, and brave. Elpenor in company, at dinner, in the bar. There were days he didn't shave, when his embrace was abrasive yet gentle. When he looked at us from beyond the grave in a reassuring, faintly parental fashion, as if to say, this too is all right. As if death itself were somehow sentimental and lost. When he stumbled through streets at night, a familiar arm around a friend's shoulder, blinking at the world before him under a dull streetlight, recalling aloud other nights of such drinking, as is the way with drinkers. And his eyes swam off into themselves, his clothes stinking of spilled wine, his hands touching the unzipped flies of his pants. And there would be a marvelous story he could tell, coherently enough to surprise his companions, whose love of him was jealous and literally supportive. For he too bore them gladly. An inspissated Daedalus of rhetorical devices. Ah, Elpenor, they sighed. He was human, but could speak like an angel, in exemplary manner. And they remembered his love of Greek, his vulnerable mouth, his once slender body, his moustache, long gone, and his sleek, ascetic gait, and felt unutterably tender. Nightly he would sup at Circe's in Soho, or the Colony Room, then go on a bender at all the little pubs, and everyone would know Elpenor and greet him and help him along. And women kissed him full-heartedly, as though they recognized their loss in his, their wrong in his helplessness, knowing him once adept at all they loved, at playfulness and song, and watched him heart in mouth as he leapt blindly into the underworld, his old body crumpled, their voices soft as he breathed out and slept. On a lighter version, this is Sisyphus, my penultimate poem. Sisyphus, you probably know, is a person who's condemned forever to roll a rock up a hill in hell. In Katharina Hacker's story, Sisyphus arrives at a hotel with baggage, and he settles in his room. And there are all these noises that come from his room at night, and everybody wonders what's going on. Basically, he's rolling a stone around. That's what he's doing. He can't stop rolling a stone. My Sisyphus also arrives at a hotel. It's a poem as much as about hotel life as about this kind of burden of rolling things up hills. When Sisyphus enters the hotel, he drops his bags, he rings the bell. This is, he checks, pension a hell. Karen emerges through a door. It is all that and something more. What can we do for the signor? Sisyphus glances at the stairs. You could relieve me of my cares by taking my baggage. Your affairs are strictly your own, I assume. You'll want the very topmost room. Here are the keys. It's like a tomb up there, and Sisyphus sleeps alone, or would if he could. He's stretched out prone and wide awake. He hears a stone muttering in its metal box sealed in the biggest case. He blocks his ears. The bed he lies on gently rocks. Hotel life, baggage, minibar, TV, remote control. They are migrating souls who've travelled far to get to places such as these, as if they cured some vague disease but were themselves diseased. The keys are weighing down his pockets. Night comes on suddenly like a flashlight or mysterious loss of appetite. The bedside phone, the trouser press in the cupboard, emptiness in drawers and bins, last known address. The stone rolls out along the bed and comes to rest beside his head. He thinks, therefore, he must be dead. The bill arrives some 6 months later. The room yawns open as a crater. The stone comes down the elevator. It's a bugger, isn't it, really? I'll finish with a short sonnet called Water, which is a commission poem. I've always enjoyed commission for some reason. People say, some people can't stand them, but I love it when they say, can you have a poem about cheese by Tuesday? I kind of, it's oddly productive. And this is Sebastião Salgado, very fine Brazilian photographer. The picture, I was asked to write a poem about some photographs. This photograph shows a very thin man, I think in Calcutta, and he's washing clothes at a stone trough. He looks very thin, indeed. But what he's doing is he is beginning to dry the cloth, and he does it by beating it against a stone trough. And as he does so, there's this arc, perfect, beautiful arc of water, which rises behind him. He can't see it. We see it. The poem is called Water. The hard, beautiful rules of water are these. That it shall rise with displacement as a man does not, nor his family. That it shall have no plan or subterfuge. That in the cold it shall freeze, in the heat turn to steam. That it shall carry disease and bright, brilliant fish in river and ocean. That it shall roar or meander through metropolitan districts whilst reflecting skies, buildings, and trees. And it shall clean and refresh us, even as we slave over stone tubs or cower in a shelter or run into the arms of a loved one in some desperate quarter where the rats too are running. That it shall have dominion. That it shall arch its back in the sun only according to the hard rules of water. I'll stop there. Thank you.
The thing that we're missing tonight by being here is Tony Blair being interviewed by Jeremy Paxman. So I thought I'd try and Paxman up some of my questions tonight. The first question, before I'm going to throw it over to the audience in about 6 minutes. It's a really crazy one I'd never asked anyone before. Dedications to books, the thing that you dedicate the book to, or the person that you dedicate the book to, frames the entire book. It's the sign right at the beginning. There's a poet I much admire called Les Murray, who dedicates every book that he publishes to the glory of God. Now, that says as much about his kind of immaculate perceptions of the world as it does about his belief in the Catholic faith. George's book, Real, is dedicated to the ghost of childhood and the body of the adult. And below it is a quote from his friend and mentor to some degree, yeah?
Yep.
Martin Bell, who died rather too early, if I remember rightly, from his Ode to Himself. And the quote is, "To watch is possible, therefore you must watch." As though to say here that the ability to perceive being a potential has to become almost a duty, a responsibility. Therefore you must watch. Can I ask you, George, please, to unpack this amazing dedication to the ghost of childhood and the body of the adult and the way that this works with this Martin Bell quote?
Yeah. The ghost of childhood maybe is the easier part because those poems called Flesh are about a childhood which is half imagined. I mean, it can only be, if you like, a kind of ghost. You know, the Emily Dickinson, there's a lovely quotation by her. She says, I think in a letter, art is a house that tries to be haunted. Tries is good. Tries is very good. And I think that, in a way, is what I was beginning to say with that first poem, that one invents these ghosts which can stick around and make one's back creep. So that's the ghost of childhood. The body of the adult, well, what do we have? I think as one, I've always had this feeling, but possibly sort of getting older, you become aware of fragility. And in any case, I've been aware of fragility in other people. As a child, I was aware of the fragility of lives around me in Budapest. They were lying in streets. So no, one sees death. And one is aware that this flesh that one holds, that one takes so for granted, which is an object of trouble and joy, stands at a peculiar relationship to the ghost of a child. As to Martin Bell, I mean, Martin was the first real poet I met. He was almost like a poetic father. And this business of watching is, I think it is art's obligation. You know, I mean, what we watch, what we see, of course, is not necessarily mutually agreeable or mutually agreed or has a particular claim to objectivity. But it's precious stuff. And you have to watch every last little bit of it. And you have to try and pick up the way bits of it sort of signal to each other, I suppose. So in real, the first section is very much about the ghost of childhood. The second section, which is consists mostly of sonnets, I love poems and erotic poems. They're just poems about the body generally. And I think of them, I would like Martin Bell to have liked the poems.
Another thing that I don't often ask is about book covers, because you never judge a book by its cover, but the overall architecture of the books from Blood Oaks is married to the covers, most carefully, most thoughtfully, before publication takes place. Now, if you look at the cover of Real here, which I can't project because it's not on this website, this is a painting called Real by Clarissa Upchurch from 2004. The book was published in 2004. On the front of Budapest file, you have the painting flag.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very curious about this relationship. I don't want to get into the relationship and how you met and all that kind of stuff, but this artistic relationship, because you were both trained as artists. I guess you probably met at art school. Is that right? Do you mind if I just go show the audience some more of the paintings and how they kind of work with the poet and the poetry?
I'd like to see.
Waiting. This is Chase. sit down. How does it work?
Oh, I don't know. I know it's a sort of mutual question, really. I'm married to the covers. Clearly, I am, in every sense.
Does the title of the book come before the painting, or does the title of the painting come before the book?
In the case of Real, there's a very specific history. Clarissa had an exhibition in Budapest in 93, I think it was. And there was all this talk of a second exhibition, which might now be coming about, and there was talk of a book that we would do together, which would be about Budapest. And they said, wouldn't it be nice to have a book of pictures, and then could you write some text? I wrote an essay. And then I wrote a poem called Real for Clarissa, based upon the notion of her pictures being somewhat like, to me, stills from a film that you never actually get to see. So there are little sort of, you know, incidents, there are things that move in and out of them. So the poem was actually written for the pictures, but then the book didn't happen. But now the book is going to happen after all. I think it might happen sometime next year. And we went, when I first went to Budapest in 1984, Clarissa was with me, and I think she sort of fell in love with the place. Must have recognized something in it that related to her experience, because at that point she began to draw these, to me, these wonderful, haunted, again that word, magnificent streets in which so much history has happened. And I don't think there's any kind of conscious collusion beyond that. She works away in her studio and produces the pictures, and I work away where I do and produce what I do. But because we seem to have this common point of reference, it was very natural to relate the poems, not in every case directly to the pictures, nor the pictures directly to the poems. I think the cover for English Apocalypse was done almost with a purpose of being done for that book. But Flag wasn't done. Flag was an independent picture. And Real, I think, this particular picture, was it an independent picture? Was it done specifically for this? It was done for the book. But, you know, you can see it fits into the...
Oh, sure. Yeah. Am I right in thinking that this website, when the word available is below the painting, that means it's for sale? Well, there you go. Go to this website. Some of these are available. Buy those too. Show those to your lovers. Now, a lot of poets that I talk to here and elsewhere, when one asks them about how they plan a book or plan a poem, go all coy and shy. Because a lot of poets want to seem more, they want to seem more spontaneous than they actually are. They don't want to be seen as planning. They don't want to see a poem as a project. Now, just relate this to George's work. George writes a lot of form, and he writes it beautifully. But George also appears to organize his books very, very carefully, as a narrative, but as a formal narrative too, with different aspects, eclogues, terzerimas, sonnets, talking to each other in a particular order. They make a micro-music individually, and they make this big kind of symphonic arc of music as well. Now, that takes a lot of intuition, a good ear, a lot of planning. Do you consciously sit down to plan a book out? Does it fall into shape once you've got the poems together? Sit down, Frankie. And why do you think that many poets try and... Well, obviously, art conceals art, but why are poets so coy about...
Oh, it's Englishness, isn't it, I think. I don't know. This is very strange. When I first went back to Hungary, I was asked to write an essay about my... I don't know, just about... the stuff that had happened, or what took me back to Hungary. It appeared, I wrote it in English, it was translated into Hungarian, and everybody said, oh, gosh, what a modest man this is, what a humble person. Then it appeared in English, and so my English friend said, you're going it a bit here, aren't you? So there must be some kind of interesting sort of modality at play. I try to give straight answers. The poems are written as... There are sequences. I seem to have liked the number 5, for example. In English Apocalypse, at 5 sections, image, there were 5 poems in each. And it It seems arbitrary. I don't have any sort of sense of mysticism about number five, but it just seemed to work. Similarly, the Flesh poems are also a group of 25 poems with a series of kind of little eclogues at the end. After a little while, you think, oh, this is the shape it wants to be. And I don't imagine it works the same way for everyone, but it seems to me to be productive to set a kind of limit, to sort of set a sort of shape. Once that particular group of poems, that sequence is done, then I take the poems which are around. And I knew, for example, with the sonnets some years ago now, and these have been going through the various books, people have half noticed this, is that I've written a whole set of sonnets, maybe dozens, based on colour. And that all began by going into an artist shop with Clarissa and noticing this sort of jar of, I think it was monastrol blue, and I think, what a wonderful colour. And it's not just pretty, but it seems to have a kind of resonance. Why am I responding to this colour? And then you began to write it. And there are all these sonnets about colour, and I bought myself colour charts. And, yeah, I mean, the spontaneity. Yeah, I have very firmly of the belief that a poem should find out what it's going to say and shouldn't know. I believe in spontaneity in that sense. Right there. So practically all that spontaneity, all that improvisation, as I prefer to think of it, you know, you start with something and you think, and I'm really not interested in going where I know I would have to go. I'm much more interested in being somewhere and seeing where I'm led. I mean, after a time, you've build up certain expectations, and you have to fight against these expectations, I think. But these structures, I mean, on a slightly fanciful, metaphorical notion, I was thinking about this the other day, these structures are a bit like these blocks of flats, which was brought up in. You know, you go up and you wander up these floors, and there are rooms, and there are flats, and you don't know what's in each room, but you know that there are six floors. And you know that there are so many flats on one particular level. And you can make certain predictions about what might be in a top, how the top lot of rooms might look by looking at the bottom lot of rooms, because they're in a certain style. You know, it might be, if you're in Budapest, it might be a succession of style. And you think, well, yeah, the whole building's going to be like this. So I think that they're architectural. That's not such a pretentious word. I just mean that there is a... They feel like natural spaces to me. I don't feel they're artificial spaces, even though I have to build. Go back to Emily Dickinson. It's a house, which she tries. You have to build this house. And I think this is my house. This is a tenement block. And I build tenement blocks.
Fantastic. Could we lift the canopy from the forest and turn the lights up, please?
Mm-hmm.
While the lights are going up, I'll just... do a little bit more advertising. The next writer here is Tim Lott. Tim Lott's going to be here on Wednesday, the 4th of May. But next week we have the playwright Christopher Hampton on Thursday, the 28th of April. He'll be talking about his Oscar-winning screenplay adaptations such as Dangerous Liaisons and The Quiet American, and there's a screening of The Quiet American too. See this leaflet for all the details. Now, I'd like to open the questions up to the audience, please. Don't be shy. Who's going to be first? Victoria.
Can I just ask you how you choose titles?
For poems or for books?
Both.
Well, books are difficult. I think I've definitely got one dud title amongst all the books, but mostly I look to individual poems or the poems that seem to be set a kind of key to the rest of the book. The Photographer in the Winter was a nice, easy choice. There was a whole set of poems called Photographer. Metro was an easy choice. There was a long poem called Metro. Real's fairly easy. There's a long, you know, Real. The whole book begins with a poem called Real. But that begs the question of where the titles of the poems actually come from. I don't know. I mean, they're... Sometimes you think, I'd love to write a poem called... And you think it should be possible, but usually what works is you write the poem and sooner or later something comes along which seems almost like another line to the poem, but it isn't actually a line through a poem. So it has to sort of feel... I don't like dull titles, although I know that I've given some dumb titles because I haven't been clever enough. I can't tell you my opinion on a deeper question because I wasn't really aware of it. Secondly, on a simple question, why the Greek? Well, simply because I fell in love with this book called Morpheus by Katharina Hacker, and I thought these were such lovely things. But I wanted to say more about each one. I thought that each of these characters, what they do. You know, Ariadne, in her book, walks along the shore and has various... Ariadne... in my book, is deserted upon Naxos, you know, and there are two furies watching her thinking, you know, this girl's been very badly treated. They're going to smash the swine up. And so you'd kind of find these... I think there's always some... I think myth is so central. I think there are maybe traps and dangers in being very direct in one's use of myth, you know, to simply update a myth seems a little bit an A to B exercise. But then the myths are powerful because they're about powerful experiences. They represent them. I don't often use Greek names, but it was mediated for me by this other book. Ideally, I'd be totally unconscious. I don't know. Not very. I think when I write about Budapest or when I write about Hungary directly, then no doubt it's there. But I'm not really able to anatomize the Hungarianness of my English. It always slightly disorientates me when people point this out, and I feel slightly resentful. They may very well be right, but I think, no, man, I've been living here. That's the nicer side of it, yeah. some things you just don't know. And you know, I don't want to be a mystagogue about it. I just don't feel able to be objective about it. I think probably what's more important to me is not so much the painterly training, because what was art college training? I was sat in a studio for 3 years and people came along and talked to me about this, that and the other. There wasn't much training as such, but my love of visual detail. And maybe I think I can kind of rationalize certain things to myself, which I think are Hungarian traits, which are to do with accumulation, which are to do with... length, which are to do with a certain degree of coloratura or something like that, which sometimes happens. But I'm not aware of it as I am writing. So it is a wholly retrospective kind of analysis, really.
There's a hand here. Was it you? Okay.
Well, you can't forget Dante in equation. I think formally why Terzerima is attractive, or I was attractive to me as a form, is because it is a narrative form, insofar as you know what you have are these verses which clip into each other like daisy chains or like railway carriages. So the kind of analogy is, I think a sonnet is like a room. It's the same size. You can move the furniture around. You can put the doors here, the windows there. You could join it up to another room in a sonnet sequence. But there's something about the terza rima, just in the abstract, which makes for the telling of a story. So I think that's one of the main things. And clearly Dante is in there somewhere, but not as a, you know, I'm not quoting Dante, and it is not an attempt to rewrite Dante or whatever. But it does seem to spiral. You spiral down into things, because of this clipping form. I think it's absolutely fascinating. But people are fascinated by certain forms for a while, and then you kind of exhaust them. And this is probably one of the Hungarian things, is I work into something, and I live with it for a long time, and sort of tunnel my way here and there at anything. And eventually you think, no, I can't possibly write another sonnet. I must do something else, invent something, yeah? Is that a satisfactory answer? I'm not particularly thinking of Walcott, or I'm not particularly thinking of any other contemporary practitioner. I think we all use it slightly differently, because our cadence feeling is different, and what we pack it with is sort of different. But it's definitely the storytelling, you know, the way how, you know, in Dante, you're actually being told a story all the time, and you're being guided onto the next thing, and then guided onto the next thing. And again, with the not knowing quite where you're going. I love that, not knowing quite where you're going, but you're in this semi-spiral daze, and you think, ooh, that sounds good, I'll go there, and that sounds good, and I'll go there. It feels right. Every time it kind of feels right.
It's a very satisfactory answer. Mm. I was just thinking to myself, it's moments like this where I realise how lucky I am to have this job. There was a hand up there, but is it down for now? Is the flag down? How about this side of the arena? Yeah?
Do you write poetry?
No. I think I would have to live in the language more. And it's one of the inhibiting factors in never going back to live there for a time being. I mean, if I stopped writing poetry, maybe I was just writing prose, maybe I could kind of do it. And I may be wrong, but the kind of odd superstition that I have to be there where the language is fresh in my ears. Again, it sounds like a really pretentious kind of, you know, pose. But it is really a kind of superstition, I think. I have to be around. I have to know how something sounds when it's said. And why? Why? I didn't start writing Hungarian. I think there are plenty of poets in Hungary, and a lot of them are good. And my best option is to translate them into English as well as I can, because there are a lot of good poets, and very few people speak this language, and very few people translate it. So I think it's like a job, and I think, yeah, okay, it's a job, and I don't have to retire from it. I just go on. Not when I'm in England. When I go back to Hungary and readjust my ears, which happens kind of automatically, then I think, oh, yeah, I know what's going on here. So, you know, I know irony, and I can sort of feel shades of meaning, and I begin to think in Hungarian. It's still not tempting enough to actually write in it. I would think it'd be like starting all over again. You know, it's like saying, do you want to be a concert pianist? I don't even know, you know, I haven't got the talent, and I'm not going to start now. It's just too much.
One final question? If not, that's fine. Because one of the things that I just want to confess is I'm so naughty for saying this, because I should have said this to you before, but I was going to ask you to finish with a poem. Would that be okay?
Of course.
If it was Endra Goblins or something like that, or something.
Yeah, something very short. Yeah. I'll probably read it from here, shall I?
George will, of course, be staying behind, not for long, because it's a long drive to Norwich, but to sign books and, you know, have a chat with you. The bookshop is outside. It's selling copies of George's work, which, thanks to you being here, you get 10% discount. Would you add a believe it? Thank you for coming. Thank you to Emma McCormack for organising this. Thank you to the bookshop for being so helpful and discounting. And let's finish with George reading. Let's finish with poetry.
Okay. Well, this is Androgoblins, since it was brought up. Androgoblins is a word which doesn't exist. It was given to me by another poet. And I think it was endorphins is what it meant in her family. Androgoblins, it's like one of those words which you half grab and you're not quite sure of. One of those sort of moments of pathos in my life when I was a child. My father used to read The Eagle to me. And this is part of the way I learned English. And I remember the moment when I first corrected him, and I felt he had read the Mekon, who I refer to in this poem. The Mekon is a sort of little green creature who sits in a sort of flying saucer kind of thing. I don't know how much of this means to anybody. It's all terribly recondite stuff, all this, you know. And Dan Dare addresses him and tells and says, "You little green fiend." But my father has read, "You little green friend." And I said, "No, Dad, it's fiend." And it's a kind of sort of little moment of linguistic strangeness when you think he's on his planet. Yeah, anyway, this is what the poem is about. "You little green fiend." Sorry, start again. Forget that. "You little green friend," read my father from Dan Dare. "No, fiend," I told him. "The Endragoblins were at it again, monkeying with the language. The Mekon sat in his saucer, his green eyes bulging with venom. The eagle had landed." My father was busy with the Endragoblins, who populated every available nook of the universe, calling to my father on his dying planet. Thank you very much.